Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
And good afternoon. Welcome to The Dividing Line on a Thursday afternoon. There was no Tuesday edition because I was over in California at California State University East. I'm sorry? I can't hear you. What?
You were in California.
Boy, that was really lame.
Well, you... I'm just sitting here mouthing things on the other side of the glass.
Yeah,
you're distracted.
Well,
you're always doing that.
There talking to me, and you're distracting me. You're distracting me. Stop it. Get out of here. Turn that thing off. I'm trying to do a show here. Man, I tell you, it's hard to get good workers these days. It really is. It's just tough. Anyways, yes, California State University, East Bay, Hayward, whatever other names they have. I guess you say Hayward, now it says East Bay. I don't know. Anyway, for those of you who haven't noticed, this will appear tomorrow morning on the blog. I have placed the video from the debate. Well, all right, I have placed the video from my little Casio teeny tiny credit card sized camera, which was sitting on a chair in the first row. But somehow, and I didn't really put any effort into this at all, but it was framed up about as perfectly as it could be. It was, I don't know if Figgy helped with that or not. Figgy might have helped to get it framed up right. But anyway, it was on a little teeny tiny tripod on the front row, and they were supposed to have somebody there to record it, but the student never showed up. So thankfully, I have a, between my MP3 player, which does a really good job, and the camera, which does a really good job. We still got it taken care of, even though it was just me, myself, and I doing that. But anyway, and Figgy helping out, and some other folks down there on the front row. So that is on YouTube. I didn't put the audience questions up. I included them in the MP3, which I need to tell you where to find. But I included the whole thing. Well, it's actually, it was recorded on that system. Remember, we plugged it in. It's recorded there somewhere. You'll just have to find it and throw it up on the website. But the MP3 is very, very, very listenable. It's in. It really came out very, very good. I'm very impressed with those little MP3 recorders, what they can do. But I didn't put that on the video. But there are 5 YouTube videos in a playlist on my YouTube page, and they will appear on the blog at midnight tonight, and you can watch that if you would like. I'm really not going to go over it. You'd sort of have to watch it for yourself and decide for yourself. It was far too short to really accomplish much of anything, and I'm not really certain where my opponent was going with some of the things that he did. The thing that drove everybody nuts is whenever he'd refer to me, he would always refer to me at least twice. So it would be Professor Pastor, or Professor Reverend, or Professor Pastor Reverend, or Professor White, Pastor White, or Professor White, Pastor White, Reverend White. And no one could figure out why this was. He had asked me beforehand, and I had said, James is fine. Oh, no, we're in an academic setting here, you know, and I'm just like, what? What? So, you know, after about the 14th time, people in the audience are just sort of looking at him like, what's going on here? So it was a little bit odd. But anyhow, the debate is available, and you can take a look at it there on my YouTube page, where I currently have, I last looked, 749 subscribers. So I was looking for a number 750. And subscribe to my YouTube videos, and you'll catch them before they ever show up on the blog, because sometimes they show up 2 months after I post them on the blog, which is fine. That's great if you want to do it that way. So with that, the next time I head out is to the Fire Conference over in I'm hitting California all over the place. I'm heading back to California again, which is not helping my frequent flyer miles a lot. They're nice short trips, but my frequent flyer miles are not doing too well. But I will be headed back very shortly after that to Georgia, these first full weekend in Georgia, and so that'll undoubtedly help. And then Houston, Texas in July, Anchorage in August, Santa Fe in September. I tell you, yeah, I am all over the place this year. Last year was a little bit less, and then this year, all over the place. It's pretty amazing. Anyway, now that I finally have 751 subscribers now, whew, yay, all right. Need to get to 1,000, so keep working away. Now that that's over with, and then the debate 10 days earlier with Jalal Abu Al-Rub, I can say Abu Al-Rub very fast now. It just took a little while, a little practice, but that's taken care of, and so on and so forth. Yesterday morning, I got on ye olde bicycle, and I started listening to the Bart Ehrman, Dan Wallace debate. Now, I'm going to play some sections, but I'm going to tell you right now, you need to get online and buy these things. I think it's Watchman Fellowship that's making them available. It's only $10. Just support them in doing this. You need this. And now, the download's huge, like 371 megs or some huge amount of space like that. But and for $10, 371 megs, that's not bad at all. So you need to go get them because I thought this was a very, very good encounter. I have not finished even listening to the entirety of it. I've just listened to the main presentations. And I thought Dan Wallace did just a masterful job in presenting his material and in really going after the key issue. And folks, listen to me now. This is important for you to hear. This is the key apologetic issue of our day. Can we trust the scriptures? Now, postmodernists, of course, don't really, they're so afraid of certainty. They're so afraid of truth. They're so afraid of one thing being right and one thing being wrong that they may not even enter into the arena. But when it comes to the defense of the Christian faith, everybody and their third cousin is reading Bart Ehrman and quoting Bart Ehrman. Now, they may not check out Bart Ehrman. They may not, actually give any thought whatsoever as to whether he is being consistent in his position at all. But they're going to be quoting him. And remember when I announced that we were going to be having the debate with Bart Ehrman, which we are, and I once again encourage you not to procrastinate, but to get online and get your reservations in for being at the debate. When I announced that, I played a number of clips from various people quoting Bart Ehrman. And this included Shabir Ali in the first debate we did in 2006. And I pointed out books published by Muslims attacking the deity of Christ. And who do they quote? Bart Ehrman. And I played for you quotations, Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, and they're all quoting Bart Ehrman. And I did not know this until yesterday, but that Bart Ehrman had been nominated for Man of the Year for writing Misquoting Jesus. Now, that honestly, truly amazes me. It amazes me because even in the book, he admits that pretty much everything he's been talking about has been talked about by biblical scholars for a long, long time, and he's right. It has been. It's just that the conclusions he has come to is not what biblical scholars have, in general, come to themselves. So that really gives you an idea of just how hungry the mainstream media is for basically Christian apostates, people who once were Christians and now they've become scholarly and discovered why they can't be Christians anymore. Even Shabir was making that kind of argument in Seattle last year. Was, well, you know, these people used to be Christians. Now they're not. Maybe they figured out this stuff doesn't work. See, that's the argumentation that's being put forward. And, of course, in so many universities all across the United States, in community colleges and universities, you have men standing and women standing in front of classes and very boldly, without any first level study on their own, very boldly just repeating these arguments over and over and over again ad nauseum and cramming this into people's brains until people believe it. They just believe it's true. And so rarely can they run across Christians who actually can give an answer to the assertion that I'm going to play for you now from Bart Ehrman. Now, I was a little taken aback by Bart Ehrman's presentation. This is clearly, I don't know, I suppose a person who's being somewhat unkind or jaded might think that Bart Ehrman thinks that Southern Baptists are not the brightest bulbs in the pack, because his presentation was very simplistic. I mean, honestly, there was absolutely, positively nothing in Bart Ehrman's presentation that I wasn't presenting as far as the facts go as a junior in college. If you pick up the little thing I did years ago in the text of the New Testament, except for a couple of the examples that he used, everything else, I had already addressed all that stuff. And so here you're coming up against Dan Wallace and you're explaining to your audience what papyrus is. You're explaining to your audience, basic things about Greek manuscripts and textual variants and stuff like that. And I'm just like, what? This was very odd. I found that to be a very strange thing. But eventually you get to the key issue. And here's the key issue. This is what the Muslim, this is what the secular humanist, this is what the atheist thrives on. This is what they will throw at you. And you need to know how to respond to it. You cannot just simply go, well, go read this book by James White. Go read this book by Norman Geisler. Go read this book by whoever. You can't do that. You have to know this stuff yourself. You have to be able to give an answer for the hope that's within you. And if you believe the Bible's word of God, then you need to be able to address these issues. This is the stuff that people are going to be repeating to you and to your kids and to the people in your church, et cetera, et cetera. You've got to know this stuff. The big argument's real simple. How many textual variants are there? And I'm going to play this for you, but let me just give you the numbers right up front. Bart Ehrman's going to say there are between 300 and 400,000 textual variants in the New Testament. And since there are only 138,162 words in the New Testament, that means there are more textual variants than there are words in the New Testament. Now, stop right there for a moment and put yourself in the situation I find myself in quite often. Maybe in a debate, maybe on a radio program, in a conversation with someone, and someone fires off that round. There are more textual variants in the New Testament than there are words in the New Testament. What are you going to do? How are you going to respond? Because what is, if you just stop right there, if you say nothing more, what is being communicated? What is being said? If there are more textual variants than there are words, then what's the average person who hasn't a clue how ancient documents are collated, transmitted, translated, anything like that? What's the first thought that's going to go across their mind? We don't have a clue what the New Testament originally said. So you can see how many groups have we talked about over the years. We've been doing, this is our 25th year with Alpha Omega Ministries. And I was doing radio programs on Mormonism before Alpha Omega Ministries started. So I'm looking at 3 decades now of doing this stuff, almost. Not quite, but getting close. And the Mormons, in general, love that. Because they believe the Bible to be the Word of God, as far as it's translated correctly, right? And, of course, the atheists, Christopher Hitchens, love that. And the Muslims love that. The Jehovah's Witnesses don't love that. That's the least one group you're not going to be dealing with that particular issue on. So, but there's so many who just will grab that and they'll just throw it out for effect. And so we have to have effective responses. Now, I did appreciate at least one thing here. And that is that as soon as Bart Ehrman gets done talking about how many variants there are here, he's going to say something important, and it's something that needs to be put on a T-shirt someplace. And that is, Bart Ehrman will say, the vast bulk of those textual variants are absolutely, positively meaningless. Meaningless. I appreciate that. Dan Wallace will repeat that. Absolutely meaningless. Most of the times when people throw out the more variants than words in the New Testament, they don't include the they are absolutely meaningless part. Vast majority. But that's there. So, let's listen to Bart Ehrman presenting the argument concerning the number of variants.
About today, what can we say about the number of differences in our manuscripts today? Well, as it turns out, it's very hard to say exactly how many differences there are in our manuscripts today. We have far more manuscripts than Mill had. He had 100. We have 5,500. So we have 55 times as many manuscripts as he had. And this may seem a little weird, but in this field, the more evidence you have, the harder it is to figure out what you're doing. because the more evidence you have, the more manuscripts you have, the more differences you have. And so it turns out evidence just kind of complicates the picture half the time. But we've got 5,500 manuscripts. How many differences are there in these manuscripts? The reality is we don't know because nobody has been able to count them all. Even with the developments of computer technology. It is probably easiest simply to put it in comparative terms. There are more differences in our manuscripts than there are words in the New Testament. Well, that's a lot. More differences in our manuscripts than there are words in the New Testament. Okay, so I think that's a fact. But what of that fact? Well, the first thing to say about these hundreds of thousands of differences, some scholars will tell you they're 200,000. Some will say they're 300,000 differences. Some say they're 400,000 differences. I don't know. It's something like that. Between 300,000 and 400,000 would be my guess. But the first thing to say about these 300,000 to 400,000 differences is that most of them don't matter for anything. They are absolutely irrelevant, immaterial, unimportant. A lot of them you can't even reproduce an English translation from the Greek. It might help if we talked about the kinds of mistakes that you find in these manuscripts. As it turns out, the majority of mistakes that you find in manuscripts show us nothing more than that scribes in antiquity could spell no better than my students can today.
And I appreciate that. And Dan Wallace is going to make the exact same statement that the vast majority of these are spelling errors. He talks about the movable new. He put up on this on the screen, evidently, a number of different ways that you could say, Jesus is Lord or the love of Jesus or something along these lines, and all the different ways you could spell it, the ways you could move the words around, movable news, non-movable news, and how many of the variants in the manuscripts have to do with those very things that have absolutely nothing to do with how you end up actually translating any of that into the English language. But the point is that you have this presentation of 400,000 variations. And at least he immediately said the vast majority of them don't mean anything at all. They're irrelevant. They don't impact the accuracy of the transmission of the text or anything along those lines. Now, that's vitally important because remember, the debate that I'm going to be doing with Dr. Ehrman in January is not specifically on the reliability of the text of the New Testament. That's obviously going to be relevant. But it is going to do with his assertion that you would, in his own words, you would think that if God inspired this text, that he would then make sure that there is no textual variation in the manuscripts. And therefore, his assertion that the existence of textual variation precludes inspiration. Now, as I said, I was extremely impressed with Dan Wallace's presentation as well. And he provided some important contextualization of this big number. He gave us how many words are actually in the New Testament at just over 138,000. Obviously, that would depend on which New Testament you're looking at. You would have a variation between the NA 27 and, for example, the Byzantine manuscript tradition, things like that. And I'm sure that Gail Ripplinger has figured out exactly how to drive 666 out of those various differences. If she has not, I just gave her the topic for her next book. But anyway, then they started talking about why do we have so many variants? Why are there more variants in the New Testament than any other ancient document? It's real simple. Because we have more copies of manuscripts for the New Testament than any other document. I mean, think about it. If you only had one copy of an ancient document, guess what? You have zero variants because you only have one copy. You can't have variants when you only have one copy. Now, but if you only have one copy, you have also zero reason for believing that it's the exact copy of the original. You have no reason for thinking that just this one is you know, somehow the immaculately conceived and copied copy. Having lots of copies increases two things. It increases our knowledge of the original, and it increases the number of variants. This is where most people get confused. They think that the number of variants should get smaller and smaller rather than bigger and bigger. But remember, if you have one manuscript, if you've got Scribe Bart, who is living in the 12th century, and Scribe Bart has had a tough day. His superior at the monastery yelled at him during breakfast. And so he's not having a good day. And remember, they don't have glasses or LASIK or contact lenses or fluorescent lights or anything else. And so Scribe Bart, his eyesight's failing him, and there's nothing he can do about it. And so Scribe Bart one day, while copying a well-known text of the Gospels, misspells a word. A single word. But since it's in a well-known portion, the people doing the editing are just sort of flying through the well-known portions like we often do when we read books and we see a certain verse cited and we know it real well. We don't take time to read it. We just go zooming on by it. And they do the same thing, and so it doesn't get caught. It ends up in his manuscript. Well, let's say that that is the only manuscript in the world that has his misspelled word in it. That's still counted as a variant. But start thinking about it. If you have 5,500 Greek manuscripts, we're only talking about Greek manuscripts here. We're not talking about 10,000 Latin manuscripts and 5,000 other manuscripts in other languages, Coptic, Bohairic, Sahidic, etc., etc. But if you have those 5,500 Greek manuscripts, and you divide that into, let's go with the big number, 400,000, how many variants is that per manuscript? And then remember, the average Greek manuscript has over 200 pages in it. It actually adds up to less than one variant per page, if you just divide it out like that. And that starts putting a little context, shall we say. And by the way, we will be taking calls after the break, 877-753-3341, 877-753-3341, if you'd like to get online and talk about anything. But let's listen to some of the material that Dan Wallace presented, providing this kind of contextualization.
1,000 textual variants among the manuscripts. Now, we have approximately 140,000 words in the Greek New Testament, or for those of you who are anal, oh, I'm sorry, am I allowed to say that here, Bob? It's about 138,162. And I guess that puts me in your company. That means that on average, for every word in the Greek New Testament, there are at least two variants. If this were the only piece of data we had, it would discourage anyone from attempting to recover the wording of the original. But there's more to the story. Now, there's two points to ponder. First of all, the reason that we have a lot of variants is that we have a lot of manuscripts. The reason we have a lot of variants is that we have a lot of manuscripts. It's simple, really. No classical Greek or Latin text has nearly as many variants because they don't have nearly as many manuscripts. With virtually every new manuscript discovery, new variants are found. If there was only one copy of the New Testament in existence, it would have zero variants. Yet several ancient authors have only one copy of their writings in existence. And sometimes that lone copy is not produced for a millennium after the time the guy wrote. But a lone late manuscript would hardly give us confidence that that single manuscript duplicated the wording of the original in every respect. To speak about the number of variants without also speaking about the number of manuscripts is simply an appeal to sensationalism. Second, as Samuel Clemens said, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. Sorry, Bob, I know that one's out of... A little probing into these 400,000 variants put these statistics in a context. First of all, in Greek alone, we have more than 5,500 manuscripts today. Most of these are fragmentary, of course, or many of these are fragmentary, especially the older ones, but the average Greek New Testament is well over 200 pages long. Altogether, there are 1.3 million pages of text, leaving hundreds of witnesses for every book of the New Testament. It's not just the Greek manuscripts that count either. The New Testament was early on translated into a variety of languages: Latin, Coptic, Syriac, Georgian, Gothic, Ethiopic, Armenian. There are more than 10,000 Latin manuscripts alone. No one really knows the total number of all these other ancient versions, but the best estimates are close to 5,000, plus the 10,000 in Latin. It would be safe to say that altogether we have about 20,000 handwritten manuscripts of the New Testament in various languages. Now, if you were to destroy all these manuscripts, we would not be left without a witness. That's because the ancient Christian leaders known as church fathers, who wrote they wrote commentaries on the New Testament.
Now, let me skip forward past the New Testament discussion. I want to see if I can find real quickly here.
Yes. It involves a line of people with the first one whispering some story to the ear of the next person.
Yeah, this is good. I want to play this. I wanted to get eventually to some further discussions he had, but it is true that one of the really bothersome things for me in listening to Bart Ehrman is he presents the idea of how the New Testament was transmitted like the telephone game, where you start and you pass a story around, and by the time it gets to the other side, you're whispering it in someone's ear. It's been changed greatly. And Dan really takes that apart here, and I think he does so quite well.
Throughout the book, but especially he repeats in interviews and in the public square, is that of wholesale uncertainty about the original wording, a view that I believe is far more radical and skeptical than he really embraces. In light of comments such as these, the impression that many readers get from misquoting Jesus is that the transmission of the New Testament resembles the telephone game. And I suspect that many of you got that impression tonight when you hear that we don't have copies of copies of copies of copies until down the line. Well, the telephone game is a game that every child knows. It involves a line of people with the first one whispering some story to the ear of the next person, and that person whispers the story to the next on down the line. As the tale goes from person to person, it gets terribly garbled. The whole point of the telephone game, in fact, is to see how garbled it can get. There is no motivation whatsoever to get it right. By the time it gets to the last person, who repeats it out loud for the whole group, everybody has a good laugh. But the copying of the New Testament manuscripts is hardly like this parlor game. First of all, the message is passed on in writing, not orally. That would, of course, make for a pretty boring telephone game, or at least a pretty quiet one. Second, rather than having one line of transmission, there are multiple lines or streams of transmission. Third, textual critics don't rely on just the last person in each line, but they can interrogate several folks who are closer to the original source. Fourth, patristic writers are commenting on the text as it is going through its transmissional history. And when there are chronological gaps among the manuscripts, these writers often fill in those gaps by telling us what the text said in that place in their day.
Now, there's just some of the points, and obviously he had a very limited amount of time. But I think especially the second point that I believe it was that he made is one that I emphasized a number of months ago when we posted that material on the subject of we had a Muslim come into channel, and he was talking about the earliest decades of the existence of the New Testament and how could we have any confidence that it was not undergoing these wholesale changes. And I pointed out something, and I've now put this into some of my PowerPoint presentations as well. In fact, I designed it specifically to use with Nader Ahmed if he was going to address any of these issues, which, of course, when you only take 7 minutes out of 20, you don't really have time to present this kind of stuff. But anyway, where I discuss how the books of the New Testament, books, plural, of the New Testament, they come from all sorts of different places. They are written in different centers. They are written to different audiences. So while Paul may be in one city and might write to multiple cities, then he moves to another city and moves to and writes to other cities, or maybe back to the city that he was just at. So you have writers, plural, writing from different places. They are writing to different places, and they are writing over a period of time. And then as the transcription process begins, as these texts are copied, they are then collated together. Various of the larger churches begin to collect manuscripts. We see this in some of the earliest manuscripts, P46, P66, are collations or collections. And so you have what I call multifocality. This isn't happening in just one place. It's happening over time in many places. And that has a tremendous impact on the stability of the text over time. And it's a positive impact, not a negative impact, especially when we talk about those who are making allegations that everything's just been changed. I will continue with this and with your phone calls, 877-753-3341. We'll be right back right after this.
How the Pilgrim's Progress is not an easy way. It's a journey to the sun, day by day. Following Jesus is a walk of praise. Oh, it's a pilgrim's progress.
More than any time in the past, Roman Catholics and evangelicals are working together. They are standing shoulder to shoulder against social evils. They are joining across denominational boundaries in renewal movements. And many evangelicals are finding the history, tradition, and grandeur of the Roman Catholic Church appealing. This newfound rapport has caused many evangelical leaders and laypeople to question the age-old disagreements that have divided Protestants and Catholics. Aren't we all saying the same thing in a different language? James White's book, The Roman Catholic Controversy, is an absorbing look at current views of tradition in Scripture, the papacy, the Mass, purgatory and indulgences, and Marian doctrine. James White points out the crucial differences that remain regarding the Christian life and the heart of the gospel itself that cannot be ignored. Order your copy of The Roman Catholic Controversy by going to our website at aomin.org. The Trinity is a basic teaching of the Christian faith. It defines God's essence and describes how He relates to us. James White's book, The Forgotten Trinity, is a concise, understandable explanation of what the Trinity is and why it matters. It refutes cultic distortions of God, as well as showing how a grasp of this significant teaching leads to renewed worship and deeper understanding of what it means to be a Christian. And amid today's emphasis on the renewing work of the Holy Spirit, The Forgotten Trinity is a balanced look at all three persons of the Trinity. Dr. John MacArthur, senior pastor of Grace Community Church, says, James White's lucid presentation will help layperson and pastor alike. Highly recommended. You can order The Forgotten Trinity by going to our website at aomin.org.
Under the guise of tolerance, modern culture grants alternative lifestyle status to homosexuality. Even more disturbing, some within the church attempt to revise and distort Christian teaching on this behavior. In their book, The Same-Sex Controversy, James White and Jeff Neal write for all who want to better understand the Bible's teaching on the subject, explaining and defending the foundational Bible passages that deal with homosexuality, including Genesis, Leviticus, and Romans. Expanding on these scriptures, they refute the revisionist arguments, including the claim that Christians today need not adhere to the law. In a straightforward and loving manner, They appeal to those caught up in a homosexual lifestyle to repent and to return to God's plan for his people. The same-sex controversy, defending and clarifying the Bible's message about homosexuality. Get your copy in the bookstore at aomin.org.
Welcome back to The Dividing Line on Thursday afternoon, and it must be a quiet afternoon, because no one has called 877-753-3341. I know that when we get really irregular doing The Dividing Line, because I'm traveling, you know, there used to be a time when we'd actually do The Dividing Line even when I was traveling. I'd call in, and that was really a royal bummer. I remember once one of those big honking phones. Remember what cell phones used to look like? The big heavy things, you know, they'd flip open. And
do you remember the time we did it in Salt Lake where I was on a cell phone? And
yeah,
you were on a cell phone. We're both walking around the North Gate.
That's right. That's right. Wow, that was weird. That man, and the batteries would die real quick too. But yes, we did. We used to do that. Maybe we're just getting, you know, soft in our old age, you know, and just not keep it up. But when you don't do them, then people, you know, they don't get used to listening. They start getting used to the archive, and, you know, they won't tune in the live one. And if they're not tuning in the live one, they're not calling 877-753-3341. And that's either that or they wait till the last, you know, 13 seconds. Or think if I said something about Dave Hunt, Pierre would call. I haven't said anything. I haven't said anything about Dave Hunt because I have not heard the Dave Hunt Shabir Ali debate yet. I searched the Brian Call website last week, and I do not see either the names Shabir or Ali anywhere on there. So if someone can find where that that debate has been posted and how you get hold of it and what format, so on and so forth, then I'd love to listen to it. It would be painful. I would have to listen to it while riding or something so I could every once in a while run into a tree just to feel better. A cactus, yes. Yeah, saguaro. Where's the saguaro? Faceplant. Boom. Feels much better, yes. But that's what I'm definitely going to have to do. So anyhow, but I'm not going to do that just to get somebody to call, you know, about anything like that. So anyway, we go back to the subject of Bart Ehrman's assertions, and how then do you respond to the assertion that people make? Well, there's a number of things to keep in mind. I appreciated Dan Wallace's statement that he went into. He also, one of the things that I hadn't played but he was addressed, is what about these earliest manuscripts? What are the earliest manuscripts that we have? And there was some dispute, I think, during the course of the debate on the specifics of that. But he had a very interesting discussion about, for example, P75 and Vaticanus, two manuscripts that are very, very similar to one another, but are clearly not genealogically related in the sense of one being the copy of the other. P75 is much earlier than Vaticanus, but Vaticanus is not a copy of P75. And this pointed to this multifocality, the fact you have multiple chains of transmission, and they're not straight chains. Aside from it being written and not spoken, and hence that whole phone game is irrelevant at that point. You're looking at something that's written on a piece of paper rather than listening to someone whose accent may be cause you a problem or whatever reasons might be. You might misunderstand what they're saying, and you don't get a chance to ask them to repeat themselves. You can ask the manuscript in front of you to repeat itself all you want. So there's a clear differentiation at that point. But beyond that, the important point is that you do not have just one chain of narration. I remember this bothered me a lot last summer when I was listening to the debate between Ehrman and William Lane Craig, is that Ehrman went off into this discussion about, you know, well, how did somebody in Rome come to believe in Jesus, and it was this one step, very similar, interestingly enough, to Richard Dawkins' blind watchmaker, neo-Darwinian micromutational evolutionary theory idea of one small mutation followed by one small mutation, followed by one small mutation. Same kind of argumentation going on here, and that's just not how it happened. It couldn't have been how it happened, given the complexity of the situation that the early church was facing, because the early church was a persecuted church during that formative period, up until 313. So for about 200, you know, when does persecution begin? Some people look at, well, look, it happened in Jerusalem. Well, if you start, if you look at imperial persecution, if you look at the Roman Empire and its persecution, probably around 50 to 55, you get the Jews and the Christians kicked out of Rome, and then slowly the differentiation between the two takes place, and you've got the imperial persecution of the Christians, at least beginning in 60, 64, the period around there. So you're talking up to 313 A.D. with the peace of the church. And it's not as intense at every point, in every place, but it is imperial persecution. It still means that during this period of time, Rome's trying to destroy the Christian scriptures. Christians are having to move around. They're having to try to protect their scriptures. And this is a completely different context than you have. And I was ecstatic. I was very, very ecstatic when Dan Wallace raised the issue of the Uthmanic revision of the Quran. I was so happy to hear that. But believe you me, I'm going to raise it in January too, because I would love to get some comments from Dr. Ehrman on that particular subject. Just simply because there are so many people who promote the Quran who think that he himself, would be supportive of their supporting the Quran. But anyway, he raised that issue, and he contrasted it with that which you have in the New Testament. And the transmission methodologies are completely different. So let's say, just off the top of our head, let's say we go with the big number of 400,000 textual variants. And you divide that by 5,500 Greek manuscripts. That comes out to 75. It's a nice round number. Let's go to 75 variants per Greek manuscript. Now, there's actually going to be less than that in some of the earlier manuscripts because they're not that big, and obviously more in later manuscripts because they are rather big. Now, if we have 75 variants per Greek manuscript, and you have, let's go with a low number. Let's keep using the numbers here that are going to be bad for our case. Let's say these Greek manuscripts average about 200 pages in length. Remember, there was 1.3 million pages that Dan mentioned. That comes out to one variant per every 2 2/3 pages. 2 2/3 pages. All right. Now, what I would do is, if I was in a conversation, let's say it's not in a, or, well, okay, I could even do it in a public context too. But let's say, just for the fun of it, that you're in what context you're going to be in. You're on an airplane. And someone has seen that you're reading a Bible, and so this conversation has started. Maybe some other people are sort of listening in. It's not so unusual. I'll never forget flying back from Salt Lake City. Me and my son Josh were flying back from Salt Lake City from General Conference in the Mormon Church a number of years ago. And we got on a America West flight coming out of Salt Lake to Phoenix on, I think it was Sunday morning. And there had to have been 50 Mormon missionaries on this flight, just fresh out of the missionary training center. And guess what happens? But this Mormon missionary gets the window, and Josh and I get the middle and the aisle. Let me tell you something. That was the most interesting flight that fellow had ever had. Actually, it's the first airplane flight he had ever had. He almost blew an entire roll of film on takeoff. out the window. I mean, this poor kid. Oh, we had a great conversation. So anyways, it can actually happen. So you're on a plane and someone has read Bart Ehrman and loud enough for people around to hear. Yeah, but as Bart Ehrman has proved, there's 400,000 variants in the New Testament, and that's more than there are words in the New Testament. What do you think about that? And you come back and say, well, I think we need to hear the rest of the story. And that is the reason there are so many variants is because we have more manuscripts than any other ancient document in antiquity. We have about 5,500 of them. And if you take that 400,000 and divide them amongst those 5,500 manuscripts, and you look at the average length of those manuscripts, that's exactly one error, including spelling errors, in 2 2/3 pages of handwriting using a quill, sometimes on papyrus or sometimes on leather. Let me ask you, if we took everybody in this airplane and we asked them to do nothing more than to copy 5 pages out of the SkyMall catalog, would we get anywhere near that level of accuracy in a modern context that we have with the New Testament in an ancient context over time? At that point, you would hear the roar of the engines, the whistling of the wind over the wings, the hiss of the air coming out of the vent above you, the snoring of the big guy at 3 seats back. Yes, but you wouldn't hear much else, because that's not what they normally would hear. Yeah, so that's what I would do. But anyways, is all of this relevant to the debate we're going to be having in January? You better believe it is, and it's going to come back up then. But there's going to be more of a theological element in our discussion, of course, because he's saying that these, by vast majority, irrelevant, the vast bulk, and Dan Wallace said 99% of all the variations, irrelevant. And I think Ehrman would have to agree that that 1% left precludes inspiration. That if God wanted to have us, then, and of course, I hope we will have the opportunity of getting into his favorite textual variants. Excuse me, his favorite textual variants have to do with like Matthew 24. And did Jesus know the day and the hour? And then for some reason, he just really focused on whether Jesus had anger in healing a leper. Even though Mark elsewhere says that Jesus had anger in other contexts, for some reason that's just, he always goes after that one. And maybe John 1:18 too. Well, we'll be looking at some of those variants. Those things will be coming up as we have opportunity of looking at them. So, 877-753-3341 is the phone number, and let's start off with some of our callers with Stephen. Hi, Stephen. How you doing?
Hey, Dr. White. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
Well, I got a break from the scriptorium, and I can ask one question.
Well, I wasn't talking about you.
Oh, you weren't talking
about me. No, I was talking about Bart, you know,
yeah,
describe Bart.
You were talking about a guy with poor eyesight.
Well, you know what? In my mind, I was thinking about Bart Ehrman, but hey, you know what? I think you fit a little bit better, so we'll go with that.
Okay.
Yeah, manuscripts that you would copy would be really, really interesting.
Yes, they would. It would be a challenge for anybody.
I would hate to be the guy who's copying the manuscript after you got finished copying.
Well, you said you can actually translate what I put into channel.
But that's only because I ordered the universal translator from the Star Trek Online place, and so that's how I do it.
Okay. The other thing too is you don't want to listen to the Dave Hunt Shabir Ali debate.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Listen. I can't promise, but maybe Neil and I can find something for you. I'll mention it to him, and maybe we can contact some of the guys and see if they have a copy of it.
Well, I'm just waiting to. Isn't Brian Call going to make it available?
You know what? He did such a terrible job. I don't think he'll ever put it up.
Hmm.
I mean, it was.
You know what? I'll just have to put the call out. I know that the folks at Bree and Call do listen to the program, so I'm just going to put the call out. Maybe some of the folks listening to the program can contact Bree and Call and say, hey, are you going to make those debates available? And if so, when do you expect them to be available?
Yeah. Well, I like to say it was brutal.
Well, I know. That's what you said when you called in right afterwards. Well, actually, your friend called in and gave the report. And I understand that it was, but I still think it would be worthwhile to listen to just to hear how it went. So
okay, listen, don't want to keep you. The reason for my phone call is basically I'm reading the arguments that Muslims use about Deuteronomy 18, where Moses and Muhammad are the same, you know, that Muhammad is the prophet like Moses. And I was wondering, what was the expectation of the first century Jews when they asked whether Jesus was the prophet?
Well, when you say when they asked, was Jesus the prophet?
Basically make in reference to the Deuteronomy 18 passage. I mean, you read about it in John where they say when Jesus feeds 5,000, could this be the prophet? When they were when they saw John the Baptist, they were asking, "Are you the prophet?" He denies it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of that is connected in intertestamental literature to the return of Elijah as well, which comes up. But sometimes it is differentiated as well. Some say the prophet, some say Elijah, some say, which I found was really odd, Jeremiah, when the apostles answer the question in Matthew chapter 16, "Who do men say that I am?" They came up with some very interesting responses. There wasn't any one singular, consistent intertestamental picture of the Messiah. Obviously, different groups painted with different colors. In essence, the Zealots would have one particular emphasis, and other people would have others. And of course, there was great confusion because of the suffering servant passages and things like that, and that didn't fit with the idea of a conquering hero. And then how does the Deuteronomy 18 text fit in with that? Some, as I recall, fit that together with Elijah. Others kept it separate. You know, obviously, small apocalyptic groups like the Essenes could read into any number of texts all sorts of modern fulfillments in their particular day, especially when they were cast out from the mainstream of Judaism. It would be very easy for them to see in the evil prophets various parallels to Old Testament texts and things like that. But there was a discussion about the prophet, which could either be Elijah or the Deuteronomy 18 alone fulfillments. And the idea that, you know, that somehow would have something to do with a non-Jewish Arabic-speaking person from Saudi Arabia in the modern area would have left any Jewish person in the first century looking at you just a little bit oddly had you suggested that was going to be fulfilled by a non-Jew who had no connection whatsoever, not even a knowledge of the Torah in any sense outside of quoting the Lex Talionis and a few things like that. So certainly that would have been something they would have looked at you and gone, what are you possibly talking about?
What about with Peter and his sermon when he seems to refer to Christ as being the prophet?
Yeah, well, the New Testament writers themselves then pick up on all of these messianic prophecies, including the Deuteronomy 18 text, and they make application to Christ. And I would imagine that time period where Jesus is ministering, for example, to the men on the road, and then to the disciples during that period before his ascension to heaven, where he opens the scriptures to their minds, would be a time period where these initial understandings of these texts are presented. Now, today, of course, the skeptic and the Muslim, ironically hand in hand, look at any kind of text like that and just go, well, that's just later generations scouring the Old Testament to find anything they can dig up and then creating the stories of Jesus in light of those things. Backwards engineering, in essence, is what John Dominic Crossan would say, or individuals along those lines. And unfortunately, evidently, the Muslims join hand in hand with that themselves to try to get rid of them. Okay?
Okay, well, thank you so much for your answer.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And let's continue on and talk with Corey. Hi, Corey.
Yes, hello.
How are you doing, sir?
Hey, this is Phonies from the channel.
Yes, sir.
How are you?
Pretty good.
Actually, my question is regarding your translation of Philippians 2:6, basically kind of that whole passage. I read your article that you had on the Christian Soldiers Ministry, where you explained that. I was wondering, firstly, in your translation of, let me grab it, of Harpagmon, is you translate it as, I'll just read it first so the listeners know what we're talking about. It says, who, although he eternally existed in the very form of God, did not consider that equality he had with God the Father something to be held on to at all costs. I was wondering, firstly, on if you see the second phrase where he's referring to that equality with he had with God, the same way of saying that when it refers earlier, saying that he eternally existed in the very form of God, do you see those as being synonymous, or is it describing two different things?
Well, if they were synonymous, there wouldn't really be any reason to repeat them. The first phrase is in reference to the form of existence that is going to then be contrasted with taking the form of a bondservant. And I would say that the equality with God that is not grasped is the result of the fact that he has existed and has been existing in the morphe theou, in the form of God. But what's really being emphasized is the very nature that was his. And as I explained in the article, the point here, I think the overriding contextual consideration, and in that article, interestingly enough, I review Dan Wallace's interpretation, which is different than mine.
And
respond to some of the things that he says about this very issue. But the overriding consideration of this text has to be the fact that it is functioning in a particular way, and that is that Paul is exhorting the Christian believers to humility of mind. Tapainosafrune is the attitude, and he is now providing the classic example of what humility is. And if existing in the form of God does not result in having equality with God, so if there is an essential subordination in the nature of the Godhead at this particular point in time, then the illustration itself does not function in such a way as to be supportive of what Paul is saying. Because it would not be humility on Christ's part to not grasp at an equality that was not actually his. No one would say that when a angel abides its first estate rather than rebelling and trying to become equal with God, that means that they're humble. No, they're just not committing blasphemy. We are completely out of time. I apologize for that, Corey, but hopefully that provides at least some of the information there. And I totally lost track of the time there, so I apologize for that. Thank you for your phone call today, sir. And we will have to put a clock right in front of me next time, because as I start talking about Philippians 2:5-11, I lose track of all time completely. So thanks for listening to The Dividing Line today. I hope you caught a lot of what we were trying to say, because honestly, this really is the key apologetics issue today. So I hope it was helpful to you. We will see you, Lord willing, next Tuesday, regular time here on The Dividing Line. God bless.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracts. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.